Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hey, I'm Brandon Metcalf with Place Technology. I'm CEO and co-founder.
Brandon, thanks so much for making time to join us on Ivy Podcast. Before we dive in and talk a little bit, you know, about Place Technology, and I'm very excited about this conversation, give us a thumbnail version of your career to date.
A thumbnail. So I started off in financial services, stumbled into staffing and recruiting, got really frustrated with software that we had in staffing. So I decided I could build a better operating system. Started building that in 2009, sold it in March of 2018. And then while building that company, I discovered the challenge that corporate finance has. Decided to build a product to solve that, which is what we're doing now with Place.
Wow, that's super exciting. To take this a little bit back, when you had built the staffing technology solution, tell us a little bit more about that. What specific problem have you seen out there as a practitioner, I guess, in first place? And how did you go about building out a solution that will fix that?
Yeah, I mean, for that company, so I was working in the staffing and recruiting industry and had worked for, you know, a big billion-dollar company like Kelly Services and had a variety of leadership roles with them. And then I was recruited by a retained headhunting firm in San Francisco and started working for them and eventually took over running technology for it. So I got to see every single role that was in the recruiting business and never really understood why there were so many different softwares and nothing ever worked together. So I came up with the idea of building one product that could streamline the entire process. So I started building that in 2009. We commercialized in 2011 and it had some pretty crazy growth. We went from, you know, just an idea to having nine offices in 8 countries literally around the world with multi-billion dollar staffing firms using our products and smaller ones using it as well. So it was quite the ride, but it was really just how do we simplify the workflow of people in that type of business?
Yeah, absolutely. The reason I ask about that is because I'm very familiar with that solution that you've been building, because during my time in the corporate sector, especially in healthcare space, we were going through some transformation initiatives and we had evaluated a couple of solution providers in the ATS space, and Talent Rover was obviously one of them as well. And we had, vendor evaluation process. So got a chance to see a lot of demos of the different products. So definitely congrats on all of that great success. So fast forward, now you're in the kind of the fintech, the finance sector. Tell us a little bit more about the Place technology and what problem are you solving there?
Yeah, I mean, so it came from Talent Rover. So it's kind of like all these businesses I built are really just solving pain problems for pain points that I live with. So, you know, to give some context about Place, the idea essentially came because at Talent Rover, we raised about $28 million for that business. 25 of that came from angel investors, and the rest came from our largest client. And, you know, to raise that kind of money from angels especially, but really from anyone, you've got to do two things pretty well. You've got to execute, you got to hit the numbers you say you're going to hit. And then I think the second thing is you really have to understand your finances and how you're going to get there and what your cash looks like and all of that. So I ended up developing all of these financial models in Excel. And, you know, we built them over the life of the business. So it was 7-8 years of using these models, perfecting them, catching the mistakes, finding out what didn't go right or wrong with them, and just making them better. I got really good at forecasting, got really good at cash forecasting specifically. But they were a pain to use. A lot of copy and pasting, a lot of errors, breaking formulas. And, you know, the bigger piece was just the time. So with Talent Rover, we had all those offices around the world. So I was literally spending about half of my month flying around the world every single month. But I was still spending personally about 20 to 30 hours a month on these spreadsheets while running the company. And then our accounting team was spending well over 100. So just super, super time consuming. So when we sold Talent Rover in March of 18, I started to figure out what I wanted to do next. And one of the things that helped me figure that out is I just started doing consulting. So I started consulting tech and services companies, and it really became clear that they had the same exact struggle that I had, which was I want to create these models. I want to run the business with data. I want to really understand what's happening. But It's time consuming. A lot of people don't know how to do it. It's just a pain. And when you look at software that was available, like we bought software at Talent Rover to solve the problem. But after 9 months of trying to implement that software, we scratched it because really all the players in the space are for enterprise. There's nothing really that I saw that was a really good SMB mid-market solution. So when we started to conceptualize what we wanted to do, of course we wanted to solve this forecasting problem, but we started to think broader than that. What else would we want to solve? Like, why is forecasting or creating financial reports and all of that so difficult? One, it's yes, the understanding of how all of it works and making sure you're in compliance with like GAAP and all of that, so your forecasts eventually tie up to your actuals. But I also wanted to solve like this flow of data piece. Like, why do you have to copy and paste so many different pieces of data into these spreadsheets to get them to produce what you want them to produce? Because that's where a lot of the errors happen, is you transpose something, you copy something wrong, whatever. So we wanted to solve that flow of data. We also wanted to get the business and the finance aligned. How often, like you've been in business for a while, how often are you trying to look at like making a decision and you wish you had financial information at your fingertips to help support and validate that decision? But a lot of times it takes 4, 6, 8 weeks past the period in order to get that. So we wanted to have real-time financial information available so the business can make better decisions, while also streamlining the operational flow. So what Places really became is, yes, we do dynamic forecasting and planning and all of that, but we also do like a lot of RevOps stuff. So we move revenue through like the initial opportunity all the way through getting invoicing and collecting cash and going back. And we also have, I think we're still really the only product that brings finance into the actual operating system where the business operates. So we looked at Salesforce as that operating system, because I think if you look at everything Salesforce is doing, it's clear that they've become an operating system, so that business and finance actually are in the same environment so they can have conversations and collaborate, because finance needs to trust the information it's getting from the business as much as business needs the financial information available to make a better decision. So we started this in at the very end of 2018, really started building product in the beginning of 2019, and then started selling in January of 2020, which, let me tell you, launching a software company right before a global pandemic was definitely a challenge, but we're glad we did it.
Well, that's super exciting and relatable on so many levels, because we've closed the pre-seed round for the technology company that I'm building right before the pandemic hit. But luckily everything went through, so we started building. But then, to your point, launching, which we've launched at the beginning of 2021, I'm sorry. And that's been quite an interesting, pivot, to say the least, in terms of being able to account for all of the things that were going on. But to take this a little bit back, you've mentioned, which was really, really interesting, and I can respect how difficult and also exciting that was for you to raise the angel round. And I think you mentioned 20 million for the previous.
Well, that was Talent Rover. Yeah, Talent Rover.
Which is, from angel round perspective, you know, I'm very active in angel investing, and I've actually, you know, have an SPV vehicle where the group of us, we invest together as, you know, as technology execs, backing, you know, exceptional founders. Nice. But from the angel round perspective, that's an insane round. That's an insane amount.
Well, it's kind of interesting though, because it wasn't just one round and it wasn't just at one time. So we raised that over the course of the business, which was a different strategy that we had. So we never did a proper institutional round. We never really wanted to. So all the funds we raised were from angels, and it was good and bad. Like, luckily we had some angels that really supported us, and I'm very fortunate. Most of those angels are now invested in Place as well. So we're trying to make the magic happen a second time. But it also came with some challenges. Like, we were selling to these multi-billion dollar recruiting firms, and they were looking at us going, wait, you guys are not institutionally backed. This is all angels. Are you going to run out of cash? Like, it created risk for them. Mm-hmm. So we actually started at looking at doing an institutional-led Series A in the beginning of 2017, really just to give these bigger companies some comfort that, yeah, we're okay, we're stable and all of that. Mm-hmm. Luckily or unfortunately, or however you want to say it, at the same time we started doing that Series A, our largest competitor started to pursue us to acquire us, which we eventually sold to them instead of actually raising the A round.
Yeah, that's that we could probably spend the rest of the episode talking about this, because that's you know that space is super interesting to me, heavily involved. But to take this a little bit further, so you've been in staffing space for quite some time, building technology solution for this. I'm sure you deal with a lot of that right now when it comes to attracting the top talent for your team, for, you know, and maybe some of your clients dealing with a lot of that, especially in technology. It's highly competitive, candidate-driven market. What really helps you succeed in that space in terms of being able to surround yourself with, you know, top performers? What are the strategies that you deploy to be able to do that?
It's really hard right now. I mean, the staffing market, the labor market is just, it's difficult to find top talents because it's so competitive, especially now with the transition where a lot of people can just work from anywhere. So it's exciting, but it's also a different way of thinking about how do you attract the talent. We focus a lot on culture. We focus a lot on trying to find people that really get what we're trying to do and fit into the core values. And we talk about the core values a lot, and they actually really mean something. Actually, I have one of them behind me on the wall, so they're all over the place. But we live and breathe them because I think they are foundational in getting people to actually be part of what you're trying to build. Building a, you know, a startup is one of the most difficult things to do, not only for the founder, but it's also equally really tough for, you know, the team, and everyone has different risks and different stress, and it's not for everyone. I learned at Talent Rover that you're going to hire some really great people, but startup life or early company life isn't going to work for everyone. And you have some, you'll sometimes have good talent that decide to leave, and they'll go to super large companies because they realized, okay, this isn't for me, which that's great. And that's fine. So we try to get better at identifying that. There's a tool that I use that I love that really helps us. It's called Culture Index, where it basically is a sort of like a, it shows you how people are hardwired and how they think. So almost like a assessment or personality test, but we use it not so much to really grade on that. We use it as a communication tool because it teaches you how to talk to people, and it teaches you, like, do they have the personality for the role and things like that. So that's helped us make some hiring decisions as well. That more importantly, once we have someone hired, helps us understand how to coach them and mentor them and make sure they're getting what they need to be successful so we can retain them, which is also difficult to do in this market. SaaS, especially SaaS sales right now, super hard to find people, but we're constantly networking, meeting people, getting referrals, and we're just trying to make sure we always do what we say we're going to do. One of our values is radical candor. So everyone should know, you know, where they stand, what's going on with the company. I'm a bit more, I share more information than maybe I should sometimes. Like, I share our financials. I think everyone should know where we're at, what's going on, so that they can make decisions. And really, I try to trust the team so that they can do the best they can do and not necessarily need like blessing or whatever. Just do what you think is right. And that's helped us. And I think that fits into the culture of the type of person that works with us. And that type of person will do well here. So it's tough. There's no silver bullet, but I think now people are just really wanting to get behind something they can believe in, not just from a product standpoint, but from a culture standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. And to take that a little bit further, you started talking a little bit about interviewing, which is a space that's extremely difficult. And I've yet to see, you know, mainly because from my observation, a lot of interviews based on that past experience, which is very flawed and eliminates the whole vision for hiring for strength versus that lack of weakness. What can I tolerate in that particular candidate? What are interviewing techniques or maybe favorite questions that you like to ask in your interviews? Or more importantly, what do you look for in the responses when you talk to the candidates?
You know, I actually think it starts one stage before that, and it's the job description or the job spec. I think a lot of times you interview candidates, and if you don't really know the job spec, you're not going to ask the right questions and you're not going to be talking to the right people. So making sure you really understand what is going to make someone successful in the role and really what is the role, that's the first thing. And then when you get into the interview, when I get into the interview now, like I used to be a recruiter, so I've read, you know, thousands and thousands of resumes. I don't actually spend a lot of time on the resume. I skim through it to make sure it says what I would think it would say. But then I go to LinkedIn, and then I do some social searching as well to see if I can find more information about that to try to get some flavor for who they are. And then my interview structure is usually, you know, half of it me asking them questions about their background and who they are, what makes them tick, why they're interested. Like, that's a big thing. Why are you interested in Place? Like, why is this? We're a risky early stage startup that has something that's very different from the rest of the market in our category. Why would that attract you? And just see what they say. And I'm not looking for a perfect answer. I'm just trying to see how they think and why this is interesting to them. And I've interviewed enough people from not only this company, but my last company to get the responses that would allude to, you haven't really thought about what it's going to be like to work in a startup. You just think it's going to be fun to work in a startup. And those people terrify me because yes, it's fun, but it's a lot of hard work. And I try to make sure they know what they're going to get into before they get hired. But then the second half of the interview is actually, I think, even more important because I want them to ask me questions. What do you want to know? So by the time they interview with me, they've met with two or three different people already. So they should be prepared with questions and really wanting to get behind the skin of, okay, what is this company? Who is this founder? You know, why do I want to work with this team and all of that? And if they don't have a lot of questions lined up, there's nothing else they want to know. That's a red flag. Are you really serious? Or is this just one of the jobs that you're interviewing for? So I think that's a good trick that a lot of interviewers don't do is to get the candidate to really grill you or ask you questions to understand why.
Love that framework in the sense you create their environment for a two-way street, two-way conversation versus just you asking all the questions and then reserving the last 5 minutes of the interview for them to do that. And I think it's, you know, I see a lot of that. I see a lot of really successful executives that do that, embrace that as a conversation versus the interview that you only, you know, are entitled to ask all the right questions. Because at the end of the day, if the candidate cannot make that determination, whether you are the right leader or this is the right environment for them to succeed at, that's just going to, you know, create more problems down the road if they do decide to take on that opportunity.
I also think it shows you how they think.
Yeah.
And like when I want them to ask me questions about me or the company, it has nothing really to do with me or the company. Yeah. What's really interesting? Where does your mind go? What's important to you? And those things start to come out and that helps you figure out, are they going to be a culture fit?
Right. Absolutely. To shift gears a little bit, so you've launched multiple products. You're currently launching, you know, your current company. When it comes to GTM or kind of that go-to-market strategy, which is interesting space for me to, you know, to observe and study because there's so many different strategies that work and don't. One thing that really stands out is, you know, that from MVP perspective, I recently interviewed an executive at Amazon. She leads the AWS division. And she mentioned something to the extent which really, really resonated that they use an acronym, not the MVP, but MLP, minimal lovable product. Because of that kind of, I guess, misconception that the viable really creates, that let's just create bare bones and then go from there. But let's create the bare bones of what the customers will really love from the perspective of launching. Share with us your thoughts or some of the strategies that help you in the past or currently what you're doing when it comes to go to market, validating the product, and just basically making sure that you are making the right investment from a perspective of what you want to build further.
Yeah, go-to-market's hard. I mean, no one has a silver bullet. One of the challenges we have is we're in a category that's been around for decades, but yet we're very, very different with philosophy of how we want to execute it. So it's exciting, but it's also a challenge. You know, it's funny that that Amazon exec hit on something that I think is critical, which is customer love. So we spent in 2020, we spent a lot of time doing an exercise for customer love, where basically I had everyone in the company and I split them onto five teams. And, you know, I had people in engineering and in India working with people in sales and Austin, and it was just a hodgepodge of team members. So there was five teams and they had to pretty much answer three questions. What does it mean for a customer to love us? Why is it important for a customer to love us? And how do we get customers to love us? And those teams had to put together a presentation that touched every single part of our business, sales, customer success, operations, product, all of it, and present back to me and the board, this is what it means for customer love. And then we took all that feedback and we wove that into our entire operation. This is what we're gonna do and this is why we're gonna do it to focus on that. And I think, you know, from a go-to-market strategy, like that customer love piece is critical. You know, one of the execs at Salesforce, I asked him a long time ago, I'm like, what do you think? How do we become successful? He's like, get 10 customers to love you. Start there. That's your focus. Only focus on that. Don't focus on revenue. Of course, pay attention to cash. Get 10 customers to love you as your first milestone. And then set your other milestones from there. Because that will teach you, if you're really serious about it, and love is a very weird word in business. And people are oftentimes afraid to use love, the word love, in business. But if you can get customers to love you, and that just doesn't mean they like your product, that means they like interacting with you. That means they enjoy conversations with the company. They're bought in, and you're not going to do things perfectly. They're going to forgive mistakes, and you're going to work and try to make the relationship better. You can nail the customer love piece. That becomes your true north of everything you need to do from a product standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, and all of that. And then you can perfect your messaging and positioning as you go. And we spent a lot of time over the past 9-10 months tweaking messaging and positioning to figure out what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, spending more time in the sales process, seeing what works and doesn't work. And we've learned a lot, and we're now starting to see a lot of that success come out, where it's been a battle to get to where we're at, but we've had a good year and a half, and now we're looking to see what we can do to continue to grow quickly. But it's really getting the foundation, getting your house in order of who you are and what you want your customers to feel like when they interact with you and your product, I think is the first piece.
Yeah, that's great. I love those frameworks from a perspective of really engaging the customer in that entire process. One other thing, kind of the strategy that really helped in some of the products that I've launched is taking a group of, you know, existing customers and, you know, engaging them in a survey where a question was, if we were to take this product away today, how frustrated will you be on a scale of 1 to 10? And really those that ranked in that, you know, 8 to 10 percentile, that really allowed us to kind of create that segment of the customer. These are our fanatics. These are the people that we want to zero in on. And that really gave us a lot of insight in terms of some of the features that they really, you know, really need to be successful. And then
I love that. Yeah. I love that because we did something similar. You know, when you think about if on a surface level, what our product would be, especially for how we used to talk about it. We used to just talk about we're a financial forecasting product. We know that's not what we talk about. We're an agile finance platform, which is a kind of buzzwordy, but it's actually true as to what we do. So we had early thoughts of if they're not using the financial forecasts exactly the way we think they should use them, they don't love the product. Mm-hmm. Through this exercise and through listening and learning to the customer, our product does so much, it's so broad, that they loved other features. And yes, they like that stuff. And some customers do like love the forecasting and all that. But some customers are like, no, I really like this. This solves, you know, 30 hours a month for me. This is the biggest feature for me. And it's like, okay, that's cool. And starting to figure out what you're saying, like, you know, where do we invest to continue to give them the value of the product? Because our perception could be different from theirs. And at the end of the day, you know, we want to make sure they're getting what they feel they're paying for and are happy with it.
What are the different trends and ideas that you personally very excited about these days, whether that's fintech, staffing, whatever the case may be? What are you researching? What's on Brandon's radar of the next big thing?
You know, I get pretty dialed into the segment that I'm focusing on. So right now, I'm trying to evolve corporate finance the same way that Talent Rover helped simplify staffing and recruiting operations, where I just don't see why creating forecasts and doing all of this operational work from a finance perspective needs to be so hard. And I think we're seeing the finance teams really embrace it, but they also want to make sure that the business is getting the value up that they need. So I'm looking at a similar approach with one platform that simplifies their entire process as a business and gives you the 360 degree view of your business. And I'm always looking at who else is doing something similar? Where are they going? Because I really think at the end of the day, like, technology should support people to do their job better. And to give some context around that, like if you look at a finance person, like they spend probably 85-90% of their time in a month getting financials ready. However, like if I look at my finance team, I'd be like, I don't want you to spend all the time number crunching. I want you to tell me what the numbers mean and what we should be doing. How do we free you up to do that? And that's strategic finance. And I think that's what a lot of finance people want. but they're still burdened with all the admin work. So I get excited when I see technology eliminating admin work and letting the human element do what they're really good and sophisticated at versus just data entry stuff.
Right, absolutely. Definitely very interesting trends. And you know, from your personal content diet perspective, what are the sources that you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself abreast, educated on all things going on around you?
Kind of all over the place, which is hard. You know, I get my daily feeds from like Owler and Medium and all those sorts of things. I'm constantly just reading news. I like to read a lot of business books and books in general. I'm also, one of the best things I've ever done was join Entrepreneurs Organization. So I'm with a bunch of other CEOs in different businesses of different sizes and really get to understand and learn what they're doing, what they're not doing, and what keeps them up at night, but what motivates them. And so I consume a lot of content when I can to try to give some basis for what I'm thinking and getting excited about. But I love the aggregated news feed so that I can just quickly skim through stuff and not get bogged down with trying to chase down specific topics. So I'm kind of, like I said, I'm all over the map.
What's one book that you always recommend to others and why is that?
Ooh, that's tough. One of my favorite business books is The Hard Things About Hard Things.
Oh, I love it. Ben Horowitz, right?
I think it just captures, if nothing else in that book, it just captures building a company is really hard. And there's an emotional side to it. Like one of the things with me, my personality always comes across confident, which can sometimes be taken in the wrong way, where a lot of people don't see me like super emotional and all of that. And it's easy to think that I don't have emotions and I don't have these stresses. And, you know, books like that, no founder's immune. It's this is hard stuff. And I think that book really articulates it well. Tools for Titans, I'm almost through reading that book now. That's been kind of interesting and fun to read. So I don't know, there's a laundry list.
I love those recommendations. Definitely top of my list. Hard Thing About The Hard Things. To add a little bit further, right now I'm reading The Secrets of the Sand Hill Road. It's basically how the venture capital industry operates in general. It's from a partner at Andreessen Horowitz. And he's been with them, you know, since the early days of the other companies they've built. So he basically shares the kind of the quote unquote secrets for entrepreneurs to understand how venture capital, you know, industry thinks in general about capital allocation, how to grow companies, and which, you know, I wish I read that book when I was raising capital for a lot of my previous startups, a lot of which I've successfully failed. But it just basically, it's a great compilation of some of those industry insights from that perspective. So that's
fantastic. Because I think a lot of founders just, it's so easy to get annoyed that, hey, VCs, I'm having to talk to all these VCs, no one's investing, no one's giving me money. Mm-hmm. But taking the time to figure out, okay, what's their world like? What's their job like? What are they actually trying to accomplish? And understanding why deals are good and not good for them. And then not taking it personally when they turn you down. Like I typically talk to probably 5 to 10 VCs a week of just constantly just keeping the cycle going, having conversations with no expectations other than I want them to know what I'm up to, but I get the chance to ask them questions about what they're seeing and hearing. So it's another way that I can keep updated on what's really happening in the market because of all these VCs telling me what's up.
I love that. Brennan, as with a lot of my guests, I love reconnecting for another recording in about a year to revisit the conversation from a year ago, see how much of change transpired and if everything that we've discussed still makes sense. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you.
You're just trying to see how much more gray hair I have in here.
Likewise.
All right. That sounds awesome.
Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
All right, man. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.